you about this. The good news is that this year we had roughly the same number of people for child protection that we currently have for animal welfare. That's the first time that's ever happened. So either people are losing interest in the animal welfare question, or the level of interest in child protection is increasing. But something is changing. Tom, you're going to start, followed by Javier, followed by David, and then Jane will speak from a South African perspective. So, Tom,
thank you.
Do you have about 8 minutes?
About 8 minutes. Okay, good morning. So, I have 8 minutes to tell you about quite a lot of work. So, most people, when they think of wildlife tourism, tend to think that it's largely something beneficial for the people and the animals involved. If in case you missed my presentation last year, a very quick recap is that's not always the case. I looked at wildlife tourist attractions where people want to go and have an interaction with an animal. You know, you can cuddle a tiger, you can get a selfie taken with a dolphin, you can trek through the Congo to see animals, whatever. The net impacts of this industry are 230,000 to 550,000 animals' welfare is negatively affected. About 120,000 to 340,000 animals are in attractions that negatively affect their species conservation status. And that means of the about 4 to 6 million wildlife tourists every year who are paying to go to these attractions, about 60% of them are paying for activities that have negative animal welfare and or conservation impacts. That's the bad news. So the worst news is that this is a completely unregulated activity. Many countries have good regulations in place, some have none at all. And so in the absence of global regulation, what determines the standards at most venues is tourists' choices. So the question becomes, can we get tourists to recognize exploitative interactions and avoid them? And do they have any interest in doing so? So we created a survey to find out. We had 400 respondents from Australia, 400 from Canada, from the USA, from the UK, and 1,600 from China. Again, we've just seen a lot about Chinese tourism. It's a very, very, very big market. And what we did was we showed them 10 mock attractions, five of which were designed to be the sorts of things that are probably very bad for the animals involved, and five of which are designed to be the sorts of things that are probably beneficial. And all we did was we asked all of these respondents, how much would you like to go to see this attraction on a 1 to 5 scale, where 1 is no thanks, to 5 is yeah, I'll definitely go. So these are the attractions. Here you have Tiger Territory in Koh Phi Mai in Thailand, which doesn't exist. And you can see you can take selfies with the tigers, you can bottle feed and play with the cubs, you can handle and stroke the tigers. And then we have Bear Park, where you can come and feed the bears, you can take photographs as they perform for food, and you can watch them ride bicycles and dance. And all of these places exist in reality, but these are just a slightly sort of, not even a spoofed version, just a slightly less authentic. Here, elephant rides. You can go on an elephant ride in Jungle Trek. You can get a selfie taken with the elephant. You can watch them perform and paint pictures. Similar, you can go and hug, kiss, and ride a dolphin. You can watch them perform tricks. Or you can go on a trek through the jungle, and you can pick up a sloth and have selfies taken with it. All of these are probably bad, because largely, if there's one rule for going into any of these places, it's if you're touching the animals or in a position to have a selfie taken with them, you've probably done something wrong. And I can't go into that right now, but then we have these guys. So you have a gibbon trek, where you can have a guided trip through the reserve, photograph the wild gibbons, you can hear them singing in the forest. Very similar, but you don't get to touch the animals. Similarly with the elephants, you can walk with them in the reserve. Similarly with the bears, you can see them, they're in large wooded enclosures, you can get photographs of them, but you can't touch them. Similarly, the orangutan sanctuary. Similarly, here's a captive lion park where you've got lions in enclosures, and you get photo opportunities at feeding time. So all we did was, we showed these to people in a random order, and we just asked, how much would you like to go to these things? What we did first, though, is we took half of the respondents aside and ask them some questions designed to get them thinking a little bit about the impacts of some of these places. So half of them saw priming questions, the others just went straight into the survey. And the priming questions were things like, people give a lot of reasons for keeping animals at tourist attractions. Are these good reasons or bad reasons? Is it good to keep them just to make money from tourists, to entertain tourists, or would you want them to be there for education or giving the animals better living conditions and welfare? Similarly, I don't have time to go through all these, but here's a list of things people have said. Do you agree or disagree that tourists have a duty to make sure they only visit attractions where the animals are well cared for? Things like that. Nothing that will put them into an attitudinal corner, but definitely stuff that gets people thinking. I'm going to show you some of these. So very coarsely, you have the good, bad attractions and the good attractions. So this is the Australian respondents. These are the guys who say they'll definitely visit it. These are the guys who say they'd be very likely to visit it. So this is optimistic. More people want to see the good attractions than the bad ones in Australia. I may or may not visit it. I'd probably not visit it. I'd definitely not visit it. So you've got a smaller number of people who definitely won't go to see the good ones and a larger number of people who definitely will. So that's a good thing. And if you look across all of the countries, you can see that in Australia, Canada, and the UK, more people want to go to the good attractions than the bad ones. That's great. In the USA, it's about level. And in China, more people want to go to the bad ones than the good ones. Not so good. When we showed them the priming questions to get them thinking a bit, the number of people wanting to go to the good attractions or the attractiveness of these things didn't change. But, as you can see, fewer people want to go to the bad attractions. So we didn't tell them which are which. They understood from the things you can do with the animals what's likely to be good and what's likely to be bad for the animal. All we had to do is stimulate them to think a little bit before they made their choice. I find this very optimistic. However, as you'll see, the effect on the Chinese respondents wasn't massive. What we then did was having got them to answer all this, we then showed them all of the attractions with our ratings for the impacts, that what we think the impacts of going to this would be on the animals in question. We said, okay, based on this, would you like to change your scores? And this is what they did. So almost nobody from Australia, Canada, the UK, or the USA really wants to go to the bad places anymore. There's a small effect on the Chinese. Before we get all snooty and think, the Chinese are just kind of like that somehow, it's not actually there's no difference whatsoever in the underlying values of any of our respondents with respect to animal welfare or species conservation. Everybody thinks that they have a duty to only go to places that are good for animals. But this is why I think there's a difference. If you look at the top here, and we asked the question, if these attractions were bad for animals, they wouldn't be allowed to exist. Do you agree or disagree with that? Only about 30% of people from Australia, Canada, USA, and UK agreed that if places exist, they must be good for animals. 80% of our Chinese respondents agreed. And what we suspect is that it's simply the case that if you have an idea that if places exist, it's because some higher authority has taken care of the ethical considerations, then it means that you're less likely to change your behavior. So, in short, we need to make the ethical impacts of tourist decisions salient at the time they make the choice, and Chinese respondents are going to need more convincing that nobody is safeguarding them against having negative impacts. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Tom. There should be time for questions at the end, but I think we'll go to Xavier next. As somebody asked Xavier in the audience has just pointed out to me, he's never seen you do it without a PowerPoint before.
I know, it's a first for me. I'll give you the go, see what happens. Okay.
Good luck.
The reason why I'm not using a PowerPoint is because there's a follow-on session at 2 p.m. in North Gallery Room 8, where we then go into the details much more, slowly and clearly. But I just wanted to kind of come up with a headline data. So following on from the research that Tom did, World Animal Protection contracted us at the University of Surrey to do some further research. They said, if we know that we need to look at how do we inform tourists and how do we raise awareness on some of these issues, what is it that is happening in the market? And essentially what we've seen is a number of individual companies in the last few years have become much more aware of this. But the key question was, we can no longer hide behind individual companies being wheeled out and saying, ah, we have Intrepid in Australia, they're good. We have G-Adventures in Canada, they're good. As if those individual companies were representative of what's happening in those countries. So the idea for our research was, what are travel trade associations doing to promote all of their members to change their behavior? So our work was looking at 62 national and international travel trade associations. We looked at the 30 largest outbound markets in the world and what the largest travel trade association did. So for example, you know, we didn't look at Forum and Reisen in Germany. We looked at, you know, their main association. We didn't look at ATO in the UK, but we looked at APTA and so on. We then looked at the inbound trade associations for 30 countries across the world where animals were an important part of their product offering. So clearly, Uganda, South Africa, you know, Australia itself, Canada, Thailand would be in that list. And then we looked at regional associations like ECTA, as well as PATA, as well as international associations like World Travel and Tourism Council. And what we found was that 21 of the 62 national and international associations mentioned sustainability somewhere on their website. It's quite depressing. Okay, we're still at the stage where we would have thought, the people around this room, we're quite convinced sustainability is important. Only 21 of them consider it important enough to talk about it. Of those, only 6 mention animal welfare as a subset of sustainability. Only 3 of them did something half reasonable when it came to telling their members about what they should do about animal welfare. However, 16 of these associations put photos of wild animals in captivity on their websites as an association to try to attract people to come to their country. So we have associations that are not acknowledging that wild animals in captivity are an issue because we're highlighting them as a reason to come to our country. So we acknowledge it's part of our product portfolio and is an important part of it. However, we're not prepared to accept that we need to be doing something about it or going into any detail as to what we should be doing. Later on, if you come to 2 o'clock, I'll show you the list of countries inbound and outbound, and you can probably spot where your country is at. What we found with this is that we then asked these different associations on a survey, what do they think is the importance of animal welfare? What is their knowledge of animal welfare? How concerned are they? And how they introduce standards? And what we saw is that the majority of associations, and we did an awful lot of pestering, okay, you know, to actually get to these answers, and we did it in multiple languages as well, okay? For the majority of them, they said, it's not important enough to answer the question, or it's not an area of concern in my country. Despite the fact that we could see from the evidence that they had dolphinariums, that they had, you know, elephant riding, that they had bottle feeding tigers and so on. So we thought, okay, we have something to think about already. They kind of said, it's something that the Ecotourism Association looks after, not the mainstream association. But that can't be right. The second thing was, their knowledge wasn't very good. We found an awful lot of associations that when we asked them specific questions, they didn't know what they were talking about. So even though they said it's very important, their knowledge wasn't there. And so when they later on said we're not concerned that in our country there is an issue, the problem was very few people said they weren't concerned on the basis of having some reasonable knowledge about what animal welfare was. When people tended to say there was no concern, it's because they had already answered wrongly the questions about their understanding of what the issues were. When it came to standards, the answers were even lower. So what we then did is we followed on with interviews with people who were either tour operators that were already active in animal welfare. We then interviewed some of the associations to get deeper into the thinking behind some of the questions that we had asked them in the survey. And then we also interviewed either experts or people who were auditing. And when they were auditing, mostly they were auditing against the APTA Animal Welfare Guidelines, which is the most comprehensive documents that exist at the moment on this topic. And I have to say that the work that APTA did back in 2013 into pulling together so much knowledge into a set of guidelines that provide examples of good practice is really, really commendable. Okay, there isn't anything else like it. The challenge is, of course, what we understood in terms of this topic back in 2013 is very different to what we understand about where we should be at right now. And the goalposts move. And really, APTA helped us actually create those goalposts in the first place in terms of saying these are something that is of importance and we need to be advancing. Having said that, as we interview more companies, what we've seen is there's been many, many challenges in moving from raising awareness of companies to actually doing something about it. And the uptake of either those guidelines from APTA or internalizing some of that knowledge and doing something with it that is fit for purpose for yourself as an individual company or as an inbound tour operator association is really not there. And what we've had is too many years have passed since that document was created and not enough progress has been made at many, many levels, okay? And pointing fingers is really unhelpful at this point because we could spend all day doing that and that alone. So the issue here is there is an awful lot of money being made by selling irresponsible holidays where we know we are selling animal cruelty, but we're okay with it because it makes money. And this should change. We should acknowledge this is an issue and we need to move on. And we need to move on by basically identifying the key hotspots where things are worst. Creating guidelines actually trying to serve everybody for every single purpose ends up meaning that you have something that raises awareness, but ends up being fairly diluted because you can't have something that's applicable to every context. Okay, so we probably need to identify particular hotspots and being able to say, this really needs to be withdrawn and we need to kind of address it first. And the APTA approach of withdrawn and discouraged made sense at the time, but also with time we've learned that it has caused a certain amount of ambiguity. And we end up with vague documents that people say, I now understand I need to do something, but I still don't know exactly what. Okay. We've seen that money talks, we've seen that cases of good practice are insufficient, and we need to go further down the line of associations saying there has to be some minimum level of performance across our members so we know there's a due diligence, so we know at least from a health and safety point of view, my customers are safe, and that we know that my tour operators, my members, are protected from external pressures and reputational risks that come from doing things the wrong way. I can tell you more about this later on. There's a journal article that will come out with all of these details. And as I say, North Gallery, room number 8, we can then go into more details and probably we'll have follow-on questions from the ones that we're going to have now. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Javier. David Veal now from Thomas Cook is going to talk about what they've been doing on animal welfare. Then we'll hear from South Africa, then there will be time for questions. David.
Thank you, Harold. And no slides from me either for the same reason as Xavier. Look, when we're thinking about associations and how they contribute to progress on animal welfare, it's clear that APTA particularly stands out and the guidance that's been produced and the support that's been produced through that process in 2013 is considerably the strongest in the industry. Really with very few other actors that are even in the same realm, and that needs to be acknowledged and recognised. They've helped, that guidance particularly, as well as the support from other operators, has helped us make huge progress. The clear guidance that APTA produced in 2013 has enabled Thomas Cook to make really bold decisions on animal welfare over the last 3 years particularly. It's allowed us to remove more than 30 attractions that we don't think and we're pretty clear that our customers don't respond to anymore and we don't see as part of our offering in the future. That doesn't mean that things don't need to move faster. It's very clear that the sector as a whole is not dealing adequately with animal welfare issues. That's not only true of Asian or South American or African operators, but major European operators as well. What we need to move much faster in integrating animal welfare criteria with quality standards and health and safety standards. We need to move much faster in terms of the consistency and transparency of that guidance and process. That's a piece that APTA is working on particularly at the moment. I think the other thing to note is that I don't think travel associations are the only route to success in this space. If we look at other sectors, if we look at the food and beverage industry or the construction industry, for example, sustainability topics aren't solved through their associations. They're solved by independent actors and specialists and businesses coming together to the benefit of their customers.
that doesn't happen nearly enough in tourism. I don't think travel businesses are anywhere near collaborative enough in terms of solving what are problems for all of us in what's a broad shared supply chain. What we're keen to see moving forward, as I said, is greater consistency between companies. We want to see it made easier for all businesses to take action on animal welfare. And we're keen to see that that's done in a fair and transparent process that recognises the strong relationships that we have with commercial partners, but also recognises the imperative that we need to improve animal welfare across the board in a strategic way. That's it from me.
Thanks very much indeed, David. So, Jane Edge from Fair Trade Tourism South Africa.
Thank you, everybody. I'm Jane Edge from Fair Trade Tourism. We are the major organization in Africa promoting responsible tourism, predominantly in Southern Africa. We're based in South Africa. We have been prevailed upon over the last few years to try and get to grips with the issues, particularly in South Africa, around captive wildlife. As you know, I mean, the desire to see wildlife in Africa is immense. Wildlife areas, protected areas, are declining. The number of animals in captivity is increasing. In South Africa, there are hundreds of captive wildlife establishments. Even though we have done a lot of research into this area, every week we come across new captive wildlife establishments. And the issues are complex, and as the previous speakers have alluded to, there are multiple animal welfare and conservation issues to get to grips with. Just to give you a sort of broad headline, how immense this issue is in South Africa, if you just look at two statistics, and that's around the number of captive lions there are in South Africa, around 8,000 lions in captivity in South Africa versus around 4,000 managed in managed reserves or wild. And that's against 20,000 lions remaining in Africa in the wild in total. So you can see, and it, with cheetahs as well, we're not sure exactly, but we've been told between 600 and 800 cheetahs in captivity, whereas the numbers in the wild in South Africa is only about 1,500. So the number of animals in captivity is going to supersede the number of animals in the wild going forward. Now, what do we do as a responsible tourism organization about this? Just to once again illustrate how complicated it is, I refer here to a quote by the Endangered Wildlife Trust, a very credible NGO that works in South Africa and has a particular focus on these issues. Captive facilities describe themselves as a number of different things. There is no legislated or common lexicon around what these establishments or facilities are called, and they call themselves sanctuaries, farms, parks, breeding centres, educational centres, rehabilitation centres, orphanages and zoos. And how do you unpick all that and decipher what these organisations are really doing? In South Africa there are very, very complicated instances where you get orphanages that are not really orphanages. These animals have been taken away from their mothers shortly after birth. You have rehabilitation centres that are not really rehabilitation centres, or that twin rehabilitating wildlife with petting animals. How do you develop guidelines around that? And then there are many facilities that raise funds for so-called conservation, but they are actually at the same time trading animals, and they are highly commercial operations that are getting, for instance, getting hundreds of thousands of rands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in many instances for king cheetahs, for instance. But at the same time, they're raising funds as an NGO, which we need to unpick as well. So, just to illustrate as well the sort of complicated issues around conservation and animal welfare, South Africa very controversially allows lions to be exported for their bones, which are used to make tiger bone as a proxy for tiger bones and made into tiger bone wine in China. South Africa has doubled the export quota of lion bones this year. So there clearly was a very urgent need in the absence of legislation to come up with comprehensive guidelines. Fair trade tourism was particularly concerned about the volunteer sector, where often young volunteers were paying a lot of money to come and bottle feed young lions on the premise that these were orphaned lions, when in fact they weren't, and on the premise that these lions were going to be rehabilitated into the wild, when actually they were either going to be shot, well, they were most likely going to be shot. So over a period of the last 2 years, we developed certification criteria, and this year in July, we developed guidelines for tour operators to help them discern which establishments are good, which are bad, and which are ugly. We developed these around five pillars, legal compliance being the minimum, animal welfare being a very large one, human safety obviously being an issue. I mean, that very unpleasant picture you see there is a school child that was savaged by a captive cheetah. And about conservation benefit, our guidelines stipulate that captive wildlife facilities must show conservation benefit to species in the wild. And the other very important pillar was around transparency, and that was because of the obfuscation that we see in the sector. I mean, that last picture there is, you know, that was posted by a volunteer who had hand-reared a lion, and this lion had disappeared, and a campaign about where are these lions disappearing to. I'm not going to go into, I mean, I put the slide up, but just a few of the guidelines. They're very comprehensive. We can disseminate them to anyone who's interested. But, you know, this is really just some of the issues around animal welfare, around ensuring that animals are able to behave in a way that is natural and innate to their species, to ensure that if there is breed or trade in animals, this is under a strictly regimented conservation program, that animals are not taken from the wild, which they often are in these captive wildlife facilities, that there are records so that we know where animals go to, they don't just disappear into oblivion, and that there are proper conservation programs that benefit species in the wild. But this is just some of the guidelines. Okay, so I mean, how do we know, as I think, was it Wild Crew put up in their presentation, really it's only genuine wildlife sanctuaries where animals are given a home for life that we can say are really best practice, and strict wildlife rehabilitation centres, which do exist, that where the contact is limited and that animals aren't being rehabilitated but at the same time being handled by multitudes of people. In terms of, you know, good practice, this is a lot around what our guidelines about. As I said, you know, once again, the physical interaction thing comes up, and that we took from the APTA guidelines, which stipulated hazard category one wildlife species, where there should be no interaction with human beings. And then the false claims. I mean, we find, for instance, that some of these captive wildlife facilities are endorsed by conservation NGOs, and when you investigate, they have set up these conservation NGOs. So, you know, one has to be very, very careful about seeing who is endorsing these captive wildlife facilities, that they're not just sham conservation organizations. And then also about genuine education and conservation in the wild. And then, of course, the bad practice, which I think the previous speakers have talked about, and that we see so much in South Africa, the ostrich riding, lion breeding, the petting of baby predators, physical interactions, the so-called sanctuaries, which are actually trading animals for profit. These are not sanctuaries, and yet they call themselves sanctuaries. The predator breeding centers, and, you know, in South Africa, there are predator breeding centers that are making all sorts of claims. They've just had all sorts of scientific breakthroughs around in vitro fertilization, et cetera, which looks very impressive on paper, but has absolutely no conservation benefit. And then the orphanages, where animals are actually taken away from their mothers and are not actually orphans. So that's really just an example of one country in a very short speech, but we really do are trying to train tour operators, and we have trained several tour operators in South Africa and internationally as well, who are asking us for guidance. And the questionnaire that we have developed along with our guidelines, so we'd be very happy to share those with anybody who's interested. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Jane, and thanks to the whole panel for being so disciplined. We have plenty of time for questions. And what happens now is I ask you if there are any questions and nobody has one. Who has a question? What do you reckon, about 80 people here? Thank you, Benjamin. I knew I could rely on you.
Hi, Benjamin Carey. I'm currently working on a nature-based tourism strategy for a country in Southeast Asia. I think my question is, can I adopt your South African guidelines in Southeast Asia, or how available are they, and can they be transferred to different parts of the world?
Yes, our guidelines do go into specific species, which are obviously regionally specific, but the principles, absolutely, and we'd be very happy to share them with you, and the questionnaire, absolutely. Obviously, in Southeast Asia, you would need to develop species-specific and situation-specific guidelines as well, but the principles, absolutely, yes. We can share them, and they would be applicable.
Hi, my name's Claire. I'm from ABTA, the Travel Association. Just in response to your question, so ABTA's guidelines are global animal welfare guidelines. They're applicable to all destinations around the world. We talked before about the need for consistency in understanding kind of how to tackle animal welfare. So very happy to have a chat with you about how we can work together.
This is a question for the representative from Thomas Cook. I'm just curious, you say that there's a real need for the companies to gather together to sort of collective effort. And I'm just wondering, knowing that the numbers of poaching, because of the poaching, the numbers have gone so drastically down, is there any involvement with the tour companies or any of the other companies to talk with the governments and sort of use the purchasing power collectively to influence sort of the organized crime that's involved with the poaching?
But David, just before we reply, in fairness to everyone, I should say that's a question from the USA, and it's Paula Vlaming from Tourism Cares.
I think that's exactly the sort of work that we should be doing collaboratively across the industry. I think those with the most influence with specific governments should be working from a public affairs perspective to change regulation and to enforce better regulation to improve the appeal for tourists of a destination, and one that's harmed by poaching or illegal capture or anything else. There's outside of enforcement of specific guidance, there's a huge scope to work together, to collaborate, to improve the welfare of animals in the wild and in captivity.
David, can I take up I will come back to you, Debbie. David, can I take up something you said, which I thought was very much to the point, but wasn't necessarily, hasn't been picked up. If you take the notion of guidelines, and if you think about the highway code, about how you should drive, the reality is, if you have an accident when you've broken the highway code, something very unpleasant is going to happen to you. You may indeed end up going to prison. So there's some kind of enforcement that lies behind those. Now, there are guidelines which have enforcement behind them in some way, and normally that requires either government regulation or a trade association saying, if you break these rules, you won't be in the trade association. But there needs to be an enforcement process. What we see in travel and tourism, and I take your point that in most other sectors it's not done only through guidelines, but in travel and tourism these things are mainly done by guidelines and there's no enforcement. But just to finish the point, because actually you have the potential as a tour operator to implement some enforcement, and Jane, I'd quite like you to comment as well, because as a certification agency, you can take certification away. But those are basically the two mechanisms we have. Plus, in some countries, some fairly weak animal welfare legislation, but that's never tourism specific. Do you just want to come back on that issue, David? Because you started this one.
I think, as one of the other speakers alluded to, the same is true of environmental issues and the broader sustainability agenda. There is no enforcement of
any sort of criteria for progress across any of these issues from any of the travel associations that, that us as tourism businesses are working with. I think that when we can see clearly that not only animal welfare issues are critical, but also the broader environmental and sustainability agenda, that that needs to be built into the approach of trade associations to encourage faster progress. I think there needs to be some recourse for inaction from corporate entities.
Jane, do you want to comment from a certification agency's point of view?
Yes, although I have to say certification is not a mandatory process, it's a voluntary process. So it only works as a enforcement tool where there is ostracization of those who are not certified. And that, to a large extent, relies on international travel trade association and tour operator pressure and public pressure, and then government support. I don't know if I've answered that question, but I just wanted to talk to the poaching issue. I think that it's going to be very difficult for the travel industry to really to influence governments around poaching. Poaching is a very complicated issue. You know, organized crime. There's a lot of government complicity in many countries. So it's not really a case of the laws not being in place. It's the judicial system is corrupt. And I'm not sure that the travel industry really has the power to affect that very much, because tourism is, I mean, it's very important in some countries, but in other countries, you know, the networks around the poaching and wildlife trade are more powerful than tourism is going to be. Sorry to be so negative on that one. I'll leave it at that.
I mean, Jane, part of the point, and we need to say this, there's an awful lot of money in wildlife tourism, and particularly in the most exploitative forms of it. There's a lot of money being made by it. Shabir?
This is the reason why we looked at supply and demand associations, and we found that the outbound associations from mostly developed countries were more likely to consider animal welfare and ask those questions to their supply chain. The main problem particularly came, and that's why I'm happy that you are here, representing the demand, you know, the supply side, not necessarily the demand side. The main challenge tends to be that the destinations where we travel to are really unwilling to try to regulate their members at the destination level. And we can have outbound associations from Europe demanding as much as we want to go to destinations where there is good standards. We don't really have that many venues that have good standards. So then we're left with the option of, well, do we say that we are actually educating the suppliers? How long do we do that for? Or to which extent we then say, well, withdraw from that product line? And what are the negative unintended consequences for the welfare of those animals in doing so?
David, do you want to just comment on SeaWorld? Because that was an example where concerted pressure from activists and consumers in originating markets effectively have closed down, or in the process of closing down, a form of exploitation.
I would step away from external pressure. I would more suggest that the extensive customer research we've done to understand our customers' opinions across all of our source markets to a whole host of issues, one of them the welfare of animals in captivity, is one that has really helped illustrate and educate our business as to what our customers want to see in the future, and that has led us to make some quite bold decisions, which we hope that it provides space for other operators to also make bold decisions and to make progress in this sector.
Thanks. Debbie, you had a question.
Hello, Debbie Hindle from Four. Really interesting research, Xavier, particularly connected to the previous research as well. And you've also said the industry doesn't work together enough. So you have this old advice from 4 years ago, which is the only standard in the world. You've got an industry that doesn't work together enough and 61 trade associations. What next? How can we bring them all together and share best practice across those with your research and APTA's, what can we, how can we take it to the next level?
We'll go to Xavier and then Tom.
Yeah, a number of things are happening behind the scenes and they're not publicly available, okay? There's, because APTA has put together, and they'll be speaking this afternoon anyway, but because of their position out there, there's a lot of people talking to them and going to them, and this is not necessarily publicly available, and you only make things public when there's already an agreement and there's a standards implemented and so on. So what's interesting is how much awareness we have raised around this. If 5 years ago a big tour operator came along and said, we're cancelling all elephant riding, we would have said, what's going on? Whereas now we're creating social norms where we're saying this is happening, okay? But we have a long way to go. And for me, the key opportunity here is for the first inbound tourism association that says, in our country, all of our animal welfare practices are appropriate, and we want to position our country as the country that actually does the best on this topic, because the demand is growing. So for me, there's a competitive advantage for the one association, inbound association, that put themselves out there first, because there was a reluctance from inbound associations to even talk about this. Does that somehow answer your question?
So again, I look at this very much from the demand side, which is that our research has shown that almost, you know, the largest percentage of tourists you could possibly expect absolutely want to be involved in good species conservation. They want to be good, involved in good welfare. And there's a lot of research showing that if they make a poor decision, they go places that don't have those standards. They're able to appreciate that, and they did not have such a good time. And so from just the comments left on the survey that I presented, so many people, you know, we left an open box at the end, we're just saying, why on earth isn't this information publicly available? And I agree, why on earth isn't this information publicly available? There's a huge appetite for tourists to be better informed on these issues and therefore have better holiday experiences. There's just very little way of getting
that. Before we go to the next question, can I get a view from the four of you? Well, you've made your point. Xavier, would this make a difference if this information was publicly available somewhere? This kit, if you like, about how to tell when you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. Because actually, at the moment, that's not very publicly available, is it?
I think it could be a tipping point that precipitates change. The question is the industry ready? And what will be the growing pains around this?
So, Come on. Look, you're ducking out of this.
We've got
some of the best funded... I mean, for those of you not from England, we have the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and merely a National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. It tells you something about the English. Yeah. So the idea that NGOs in Britain couldn't fund this seems to me to be crazy. Obviously, they could. Would it make a difference?
Yes.
David, what do you think?
I think it would make a difference, but I think we need to look at how that information is portrayed and how approachable that is to a consumer. At the moment, there is a lot of guidance information that is available that is incredibly detailed and it doesn't help corporate entities make decisions a lot of the time, never mind a consumer.
No, one of the problems is the NGOs compete for who's got the best. Sorry, I'll come back to you, but Jane... South Africa is a country which has got bloodlines, and there's been an amazing effort to get that message out. But the country remains extremely divided over this, doesn't it?
It does. And I think I tried to portray some of the complexity. And I think that, I think would it make a difference? It would make a difference in some markets. It makes a difference in European markets and I think US markets. Unfortunately, having spoken to these captive facilities during the formulation of our guidelines, markets, without wanting to generalize, the Indian and Chinese markets aren't as sensitive to these messages, and some of these facilities are thriving on just those markets. So, yes, it will make a difference to some markets, and others there's still a long way to go.
You seem to me to be saying that regulation is going to be required.
Yes.
Marta Mills, I work on protection areas in Georgia, tourist development protected areas. So you partly answered my questions. My question was to you, Xavier. What are you aware if the results of your... Because the results were appalling and were worrying, but they're worrying for us because we understand. But my question is a year where, if anything practical going to be done about it? You know, is there going to be some sort of, I mean, maybe a campaign to influence tourist behavior in terms of, you know, providing some guidance or on changing behavior of tourists who are visiting those, you know, protected areas or wildlife orphanages and all those things? Because we, at the moment, we're looking at maybe preparing guidance for various animals and caucuses that people, there are more and more people coming to Georgia and Armenia, and they're also coming for particularly to protect the areas to see the you know, the snow leopards and other things that you wouldn't be able to see anywhere else. So, but there's no information at all about how tourists should behave. So I was just listening to you and thinking, oh, this is really worrying. But are you aware, is there anything going to be done to address it?
Yeah, so what I would say is, I mean, Harald forced my hand earlier on saying, will campaigning help or not? And I wanted to qualify that, because sometimes when we reduce very complex things into newspaper headlines, we oversimplify, and we actually end up doing more harm than good. So I'm cagey. I've been before in studies where I've put something in headlines and the press release has gone out there and I didn't check the press release enough, and boy, did it do harm. Okay? So we need to be careful with that. What I would say is we need to do three things. We need to delete the worst, we need to work with the best, and we need to train the rest. There are organizations that there's no way they can improve. There are crocodile farms that shouldn't be there. There are all sorts of places that are really exploitative about, you know, I mean, you know that topic more than I do, okay? There are associations actually doing really, really well, and we need to find a way through consumer awareness that these are the places we should be going to, and these are places we should be learning from. I don't think we've got enough role models in these kind of associations. If you're looking at, if we said, where can we go to do proper elephant encounters, how many, I mean, I've got more fingers than I need in my hand for how many places there are in the world where we can do this well. And then there's a bulk of organizations in the middle that we can't just point the finger and say, you are bad, because actually they may not genuinely know. So I think we need a three-pronged approach.
Does anybody else have a question?
Harald, do you mind if I just add to what David said? I really strongly endorse what you say. That's the approach that we've been taking. And I really am encouraged by some of the facilities that we've been working with who genuinely want to improve and have asked for advice on how. So I think there is a big sector in the middle that there is a scope to work and train with. So, yes, absolutely. Campaigning is one strategy, but training is an important part of the mix.
Hi there. I want to also add to that. I'm Julie from World Animal Protection, and it answers maybe a couple of questions that were raised. One of them, you're right, there is a couple of approaches. So one of them that we focus heavily on is reducing the demand, either directly by raising awareness, changing attitudes, but also by working with some of you who are here today in, for example, the Coalition for Ethical Wildlife Tourism. Thomas Cook is a member of that, but also many other tour operators, as well as Travel Trade Associations. What is important as well, and what we are proving with this coalition, is that we work with venues, existing elephant camps, to transition them to become better. And we as an NGO can't do that. We need the industry to guide these venues to change. But at the same time, there are many venues that will never change. And we don't want them to change. We want them, for example, to stop breeding and to phase them out.
Who wants to take that? Was that entirely right? Good. Anybody else? One final question. From South Africa.
Hi, my name is Glenn O'Leary. I just would like to make a comment. There was a discussion a little earlier, a question about poaching, which I think was sort of glibly pushed to the side in a way. And one has to remember that closing down many of these operations, if you were to do that as opposed to transitioning them, means people lose jobs. People losing jobs mean people become poachers. So there's a balance that has to be reached in how the whole process gets dealt with, how it takes place, and I think that Fair Trade are doing a fantastic job in educating people so that sanctuaries are not just closed, but rather they move in a different direction, and sometimes that even increases employment. But employment is a critical part, and sometimes we make decisions without recognizing the consequences of that decision to the broader economy.
Does anyone want to comment on that? No? You agree, Jane?
Yes. Well, there are complex issues at play.
Funny how I hear that all the time. We have a... But you're on mic anyway. We're going to have one last really brief announcement of another set of guidelines.
I'm not sure what the beginning of their journey looks like. And I think something that really came up from the panel and resonated with me was that there's a need for greater collaboration. And there's also a need for what practical steps do I take? Like, how do I make these guidelines a reality? And so you'll be pleased to know that we've created an animal welfare in tourism starter kit, especially aimed at small businesses to help them start their journey. It's based on our own experience implementing animal welfare measures and also expert guidance from animal welfare specialist Anna Mondial, who are also from sunny Brighton. So we recognize that being a small business, trying to implement these animal welfare changes has its own set of unique challenges compared to a very large organization. Of course, there's where to begin, but there's also the fact that you've probably got no sustainability manager, no CSR department, and most likely no budget. Well, we were exactly the same. And we found the ABTA guidelines incredibly helpful. They were brilliant for us. But we really needed practical help. And that was why we turned to Anna Mondial to get our animal welfare trips up to scratch. So now that we've done that, we really want to help other small businesses do the same. So that's why we've created the Animal Welfare in Tourism Starter Kit to help everybody else get started on their journey. It's full of practical tips, examples, advice, and even a short video for people with small attention spans or who maybe just want a brief overview of the topic. But most importantly, it's free. So if you would like a copy, all you need to do is head onto the link on the screen and register for your copy, and then we'll send you a version so you can get started. And it's free. Thank you.
It's free and it's publicly available. I just want to do a brief advert for a session this afternoon. The question that's being discussed upstairs this afternoon is, are travel associations doing enough to protect wild animals in tourism? And my former colleague, Xavier Font from the University of Surrey, this time is going to use PowerPoint slides up there. I'm told that we'll have those in the public domain very soon, and we'll put them out through the WTM website and through the Responsible Tourism Partnership. So that will become available very quickly. But if you can get up there, there is going to be a panel debate with responses from the industry. I'm told that G Adventures, Thomas Cook, David, I assume, ABTA, AMVR, the Dutch Trade Association, will all be there. The session is from 2 till 3 up in North Gallery Room 8. For those of you who don't know WTM very well, that means go to the North Hall, go to the back wall, look for the signs up to the corridor, and then on the North Gallery, look for Room 8. I'm sure it'll be worth your while. I'm sorry I can't be there. I'm doing something else. But could I ask you to thank the panel in the usual way? Thanks very much, everyone.